That's right. So my job is to summarize David Benham so that you can tell us apart. And David, welcome to the show. Talking about David Greenwood. Hopefully I can speak from at least a little bit of distance here from the point of view of computer science. I pretend from time to time to be a computer scientist on such occasions as, you know, orals and defenses. I know I can't fool you, but I'll at least attempt to. David asks the really pointed question of why we should have a lexicon, or what one of these this fundamental instrument of the discipline is actually for. Now, I want to point out that there's a surprising number of classicists in a lot of different disciplines, and that may have something to do with the kind of analysis that very foreign and non-natively spoken languages require. The philological mindset is close to what goes on in computational linguistics, and actually teaching a language in this way with instruments of this kind could have lots of benefits. So what David's proposal as a straw man, which we should discuss, is that there are three levels of information that a lexicon should be conveying to you. One is a sort of semantic field representation, and rather than pulling a semantic hierarchy out of the air, as the Princeton Internet people have been doing since George Miller's work in the 60s, is to say, well, we have an objective view of what semantics is. It's the translation into other languages. So, for instance, if a particular Latin word can be translated as the English lexemes, if libero can be translated as deliver or acquit, that's some evidence, because English makes this sense distinction, we have some, or makes the lexical distinction, we have some evidence that Latin can therefore make a sense distinction, that there's something that can go on inside your head that would allow you to make this distinction. Or, for instance, the fact that, English makes a distinction between hand and paw, whereas other languages wouldn't, allows you to say, well, that some people can view these two different things as natural kinds. The other thing that David proposes to have in the dictionary is essentially subcategorization and lexical selection, the sorts of things that linguists would call frames nowadays, such as in the work of Fillmore. And frame it. And that you should have that there are syntactic structures attached to items of the lexicon what you could say when you have a verb in your sentence, it projects a particular structure up into the syntactic tree, and that other elements in the sentence fill in slots in that maximal projection. And of course a useful technology in filling out the dictionary is going to be building syntactic parsers for the languages that we care about. Something that you want as a precursor to the syntactic parsers that David doesn't talk about is morphology. This is, we sort of have a context-free morphology, not in the sense of context-free grammar, but in the sense of a descriptive representation of the closed morphological system. For some languages, such as Greek and Latin, via Morpheus, other projects have done for other languages, what we don't have yet are good source models of what underlying morphological forms are a priori more probable than others. So, according to Morpheus, the future perfect is just as likely to be an analysis as the perfect. But as David says, all these endeavors should be quantitative, both for the pedagogical reason that you want students to care about things that are very frequent, and for the engineering reason that in order to reason accurately about information in text, you really need to use the calculus of probabilities. There are going to be no deterministic rules that allow us to do this kind of process. One thing which David has left out of his explicit description of what the lexicon is diachronic and higher order genre information, which I think is very important. And it's also very important that classics communicate its advantage here. If you have 3,000 years of Greek, you actually have a wonderful test bed for answering some questions about diachronic phonology, which is the sort of very reliable substrate on which the 19th century invented reconstruction of proto-languages and inspired biology to do the same with reconstruction of prehistoric species. But diachronic morphology, diachronic syntax, diachronic semantics, and all these other disciplines which classics is very well poised to be able to do, and to be able to test some predictions of how language works, which could be an exciting example for other disciplines, as well as all these other kinds of genre and genre conditioning, theme conditioning. People have kind of been mentioned before, but being able to make them part of the dictionary, not just, we're going to have a lexicon to Homer, we're going to have a lexicon to Pindar, but we're going to try and view Homer as a mixture of these different, people view Homer as a mixture of different dialects, but mixtures of different themes being put together, or to view a satirical work as a mixture of different genres, for instance, can be quantified if we do lexicography in this way. As a computational linguist, I look at this and say, what are the natural experiments that you would want to run? And not saying that, this is not, you should do 10 experiments before you publish this paper, but I think it's an interesting point of discussion as to things that the field could do. There are sort of emerging annotated data sets such as the Latin Tree Bank, which naturally call for to start asking some empirical questions about. We have had for a while, for instance, Martin Mueller's annotated hexameters, morphologically annotated hexameters, and people can, ought to be starting to ask questions about that and sort of building the prototypes of these lexical resources. As well as some of the pilot work that's going on in Tufts, David, and another David, unfortunately goes by D, Scully. Looking at clustering semantics via translational equivalents, How could that work be leveraged or bootstrapped up to the larger corpora, being able to take our existing semantic hierarchies in Lewis and Short and the Oxford Latin Dictionary, LSJ, and trying to bootstrap them into a dictionary of Plutarch or Galen or Thomas Aquinas. So what do people think a dictionary should be? I mean, is it really something we need? Or for the dictionary, a dictionary for who? Maybe it's a lexicographic process. Should a lexicographic project be concentrating just on annotating the actual texts, which are, after all, what classicists actually care about? I mean, this isn't a Cobill dictionary where you don't actually care about the excerpts from British magazines for the past 20 years. You only hear about them as ways of teaching people good British usage.
Actually, Cobill is a wonderful comparison for one of the things that real people really do with their dictionaries. Greek and Latin, and that is learner dictionaries and learner texts. CoBuild has spawned this entire sub-industry of student-oriented dictionaries that would give you collocations, that would give you frequency information, the kinds of things that someone learning to write or speak English wants, but also someone learning to read and speak Greek and Latin. Also, CoBuild lets you produce simplified texts. There's, again, stacks and stacks of ESL reading materials actually soundly based in linguistic knowledge about what is the kind of English that people are using. That kind of thing has not yet filtered into classical pedagogy, especially in Greek, and this is another place where if we're going to do all this work, that's a place where we can get a real contribution and setting a good foundation for working the next people. Sorry to be so
pedagogically. Oh, right, and the other thing that one can mention is that, you know, this is another area for getting students actively involved in, you know, annotating texts is something that they're asked to do in introductory classes anyway. You know, what is this form? And there's been some work in that direction, but
along those same line, in, you know, teaching this term, it struck me that when students come across a dictionary entry, they memorize the first one.
That's right. So it better not be organized like the OED.
So
with the historically first.
You try to have the most right. So you take something like Pharaoh, you know, and it'll be to bear, which sort of tries to get, and then it'll be to endure and to carry and so on. But, you know, inevitably the sense that they're looking for is five down the list, and inevitably when you're teaching them, they choose the first one. And then you have to go back and say, you know what, it's a whole smart work. If we could make the dictionary entry as they see it interact with the text as it's, you know, in the semantic field, then it's, you know, you could just give them that one sentence, but you could also highlight lower down, which I think would produce better.
I mean, for a lot of these things, we actually have translations, so it's the
exactly.
way to give them a trot without a trot.
Yeah.
It's maybe what you're, asking.
And I think for my students, anyway, it would be a really helpful thing for them to see. In this case, it's sense 7A that you are looking for, you know, not the top of the list.
Yeah, well, that's a part of that. I don't know if that's necessarily a part of something you include in a lexicon. That's a word sense disambiguation problem when you're reading.
I'm trying to ask, what is a lexicon?
Yeah.
You know, instead of.
I think online a lexicon is being used within the context of the text.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so I'm saying, why don't we make that integration even greater
right.
and make it a learning tool, which in most cases is what it is anyway, and make it a more effective learning tool. But you're right, I mean, you know, it's an application of an underlying.
Yeah, I think this is an important problem you point out about the linear nature of dictionaries as they exist in print. And if you are going to, you know, have not those limitations, but the free rein, right, you can start organizing work meanings more like cognitive scientists people do, and you have some central blob, right?
Right. Yeah. But we don't, but unlike cognitive scientists, we don't sort of elicit, you know, pull these nylon strands out of the soup of our brains. We actually have the data.
You cannot, you couldn't do that in print, right?
Right.
Whereas if you are going to do it on a web page, you could, okay, so you can go with the blobs, but you could also say, okay, reorder this for me by frequency rather than give me the thing that is the closest cognate in English, right, that we are all so crazy about and that is actually of no use, right? So the first meaning in LSJ, which is typically useless, as opposed to the first meaning in the OLD, which is typically actually linguistically responsible, right? So it really depends on the kind of lexicographical tradition you're looking at, and the LSJ is hopelessly out of date.
So you know,
what you would want for users, and let's face it, anybody in this country is an intermediate Greek user, but what you would want, and anyway, in the world, what you would want is that frequency information and the basics very much more clearly.
So what are the things that we need to do to be able to present that? Because you know, that interface is sitting at the on the top of a lot of different tasks that need to be done.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And the tendency of the classicist, and in part this is why they become classicists, is to think that lexicography is all about annotation of a single instance in a single text. And that is a problem. You have to understand that we still have a language underneath there, a language like any other language. To think of it as annotation, I think, is a basic problem that you have to get out of people.
But it's not a living language. You can't refer to a native speaker, so in the end, you are ultimately dependent on an annotation of a specific instance.
Actually, that's a safety, because Chomsky couldn't get away with some of the things he claims if he didn't have native speakers around, because then he would have to prove it from a corpus, and he wouldn't be able to do it. Right? And so we actually are in a much better position to do responsible work, right, with these limitations. Right? But with these limitations, totally agree, but we can't collectively get into a group thing that says, oh yes, I feel a trace. We cannot collectively start working on
right, the language, for certain kinds of work, the language is the object of study, not the text. But the texts are what everyone who studies the language has to base their models on. So, and even if people can't agree on syntactic formalisms, they might be able to agree on annotation schemes. I mean, the whole point is different people will have different theories of how Greek works and try and prove them with evidence.
We can also argue about the objectivity to pick up on your word of using translation equivalents, particularly when you're working with Perseus is a parallel corpus, which is a set of mostly 19th and early 20th century translations, not entirely, but largely.
Objective, not in the sense that the people. Sorry, I know better than you, as a human, but people use the word objective.
Sorry, you care about words,
Right. Right.
But objective not in the sense that the researcher has not made it up out of their own head or has not had to.
Well, objective in the sense that somebody doing some other task, not building a lexicon, decided to use this word here. So because.
Right, so random with respect to.
Right, you believe that the random is the variation.
Yes, the problem being that it does reflect a particular variety of English, which may or may not be the one that you wish to present. It also reflects particular choices about the meanings of Greek. And what do you do with the words whose meanings are disputed or whose meanings now rest on evidence that wasn't available to those translators or whatever? What do you do with...
Well, you don't need to... Right, you... Yeah, well, I mean, that's where it's all deeply interlinked.
Yeah, so. Because it's where... If one had answers on the top of one's head, it would have done that.
Right. I mean, so the translations are a way of seeding the process. Really, the key is, as Thomas says, it's a language like any other. It's a closed system that you should be able to study as itself. But, we believe that there are hidden concepts. There are ways of getting at hidden concepts. Mm-hmm. And, but we shouldn't forget that they're just parameters in a model, and all models are wrong, and some models are useful.
Let's pick up this term of the model, and it's one of the questions both for lexicography and for many of the processes at play here is the distinction between the perceived and then the real value of manually produced but quote-unquote authoritative objects, say a human edited entry about a putative word or a putative language versus what we get automatically, which has always some kind of, can I say objective in a bunch of, I guess you're a philologist, so I can use that term, objective error rate, where you know it's sometimes it's just wrong. And so you have, what's the trade-off between having lots of things where you usually get the right answer, almost always get the right answer, somewhere at the top, and sometimes the mistakes are useful and instructive, versus the manual production. And of course, it's not a dichotomy, just that we will never have a dictionary of manually produced entries for all 80 million words in Greek. So, and the Germans will continue.
A German's coming in the door.
A certain project in Europe, working ambitiously for 100 years, is now keeping like how many 20 people employed, and will not work. I don't cannot work on these methods for fear that the whole thing will implode. And so you have, you know, there are sort of momentum in employment in play, as well as just, you know, scuttling momentum. But the really, the thing that we fundamentally miss, and it's disastrous for our ability to have be credible in what we claim to do for our students, because it shows that at the moment, it's not clear, it really undermines the value of classability, which is the lack of ability. We do not have critical methods to really and intelligently assess the cost and benefits of our own tools, and we rely only on prejudice or on boosterism, for those of us in technology, our own hopes and fears, and have no analytical analysis of what really matters, or have no conversation and don't think about it. What the hell are we teaching our students other than not be like us? So the major issue is assessing what's important. Now this happens, it's brought home to me in a meeting in Holy Cross where we talked about error rates, and you know the classes had no analytical capacity to analyze what an error rate was. And reacted, actually went opposite. It was like, pick the wrong answer because he was thinking in terms of prejudice. This is fundamental to the culture of our field. Other fields carefully would sit around and say, well, what's the cost, what's the benefits? They kind of come up with a conversation to get the value of what the delta was. I think there's the objective stuff, there's stuff that you have to, what matters, what's true and what matters. But this is something which people need to think about. Where does our investment go? And this group's collective investment is, we do a lot of, in an automated way, use such labor as we have at our disposal and combine the two in new ways. And this is a classic instance right here in the dictionary.
The dictionary seems to me an even more suitable place for automation, in part because they're really, I'm struggling to find a place where a dictionary makes an argument for its semantic assignment. I mean, really the evidence for the semantic assignment is the translation. There might be a few articles in Glota or something but in general, there's something that we're not really able to...
It's the association with the...
Right, the best example is where Jeb's edition has the translation. He's arguing about there are lots of cases. There's commentary and translation. That's where these arguments take place, not in dictionaries.
But not every. I mean, the translation of "ho" as "the" is not. Where's the argument? The argument in that must be in the.
The problem there is that we're organizing dictionaries by words, by lexemes.
Okay.
That's the real problem.
All right, but I mean, you can expand that. It's only the exceptional that we argue about. In general, the rest of it is received with. I'm not arguing against that. It's just that it strikes me as this is a strange kind of scholarship where in other places one could ascribe argument or sort of find a scholar's opinion and assign it. Here, it's much more tricky.
Well, the opinion is expressed if you look at the Greek Spanish dictionary. If you look at Roel Scott Jones, the opinion is expressed. No, a word of Spanish, you look at the organization of the entry and you see how they understand this Greek word compared to how LSJ understands this Greek word. What you are essentially looking at is a bag of instances that somebody has sorted out for you. Has the sorting been useful? That depends on whether you're part of the same crowd with the same presuppositions to what is important about differences between words. As this person comes from, the Spanish crowd is a lot more recent than the LSJ crowd. They do a lot better job, right? You're waiting for them to, you know, get done. But grouping of instances is the fundamental thing. That goes further than just the practice thing, much further. That you need to get finer grained than that.
But to say that there's no argument there,
the structure of the entry is the argument. What is nice about having this online could be that besides just the one perspective of the semantic structure, you could say, okay, now give me the historic perspective. And give me graphs that show me what the distribution is. Right? How does this distribute over time? How does this distribute over genre? Right? All the stuff that you should really have, and that in these really condensed entry, somebody's going to trying to give you a picture of. I'm not sure anyway, my dictionaries, because the 10,000 instances or something, I'm very grateful that somebody else went through. And if you are an advanced graduate student, you're going to find what you look for in LSJ with that exact place because they worry about it too. That's what I go for.
Right, there's this feedback between the distribution of places of loci that people care about and loci in the site.
Absolutely. One of the things nobody's mentioned yet, we seem to be assuming that a lexicon is a collection of English translation equivalents, or perhaps Spanish translation equivalents, or perhaps German translation experience. But would it not be useful also to have something that defines the words in the same language, so that we have a dictionary that tells us not that pharaoh means bear, but that pharaoh means, you know, some series of Hebrew Latin sentences that talk about pygmies of a carrying. And we want that also, and that's something that we just don't have, and yet that's something that would take many of us a lot closer to using a language as a language rather than just only as
its own noisy channel procedure. And all this Greek is really in English, but it's been noised up by this weird process.
Which is, of course, how all of our freshmen see it in the first 3 weeks, right? But is
only... I mean, lexicographers would actually get very upset with the idea of the dictionary that's just made up of glosses. And the last 20 years or longer, it's been very firmly entrenched in the discipline of lexicography that the entry of a dictionary defines the word. It doesn't give you an example in the language. An ancient Greek dictionary is no different from an English dictionary in English. You define each word. The Greek entry, the English entry for bear in the OED doesn't say means bear.
No.
It says, it defines it in a sentence.
But we are many of the existing dictionaries, especially many of the existing smaller ones, as opposed to, for example, TLL, will not so much attempt to define them as simply attempt to give you several suitable equivalents in the reader's native language, which is not the same thing as a definition. If you put next to pharaoh the OED entry for bear, that would get you a little bit further. But what I'd like to see, assuming that the two words mean exactly the same thing, which they don't, but whatever. But if we could put next to pharaoh some Greek sentences that say, or Latin sentences that say, this is what it is, this is how it's used, with, again, necessary examples, frequency information, rules about selection frames, all that kind of stuff that you also have to have. But just not have any English in the book.
Well, this is partly also how the Colville dictionaries treat this. They don't give explicit definitions so much as synonyms, but support with collocation information.
Yeah.
Right. So the word is defined by the word set by its context.
Yes.
So again, you can do a similar thing with these lexicon as well.
The TLG is, of course, obviously a useful tool, but the TLG is going to be organized by well, it's disorganized by the person who's not going to be able to search at one moment across all the different appearances of the word, all the inflections of the word.
But just because their search engine is bad, or what do you mean you can't search at one moment?
Well, can you search at one time for the incorporated or the present of the given verb in the TLG?
They have their own size searching data. Your interface is a little
better. You can search for the letter of a word and find all instances, however.
But you're saying that you're restricted to certain syntax, to certain morphological.
So why does one need to create another engine? We'll organize a set. It already exists. I mean, you want to see words in certain contexts, you actually have to use the language, don't you? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I guess I'm behind the time on this.
Did you want to say, if you want to see everything, sure, out of your dictionary, which just lists the context of every single instance of a word, would be a waste of space, would be just merely duplicating what you can do with the TLG. Or simple things wouldn't be able to get together on it. You need some organizing. I mean, even the dictionaries we're criticizing, they'll both gloss the word, they will attempt to give some kind of definition, sometimes. And they will give a few examples of the word in context, representative examples. I mean, I think what we've got identifying the need is the need to give more of these representative examples, and not only selected by the lexicographer, but also to have a direct pathway into all of them. Into, if you want to go look down all these various instances where this word appears in a certain context of words only three times, you want to look at each of those three. You want a dictionary which starts from the LSJ and takes you to the TLG, optional, for each entry. But there needs to be an organizing principle there, I think. None of that can be done without those problems. But it can.
Should the organizing just only words, lexemes, Greek or Latin?
As opposed to...
I mean, so you go to the entry hub for some interesting information, or not to search it. Not to searching a tree bank of Greek. No, I'm just trying to elicit, what is it that people want from their entry on pub?
It depends on what they're doing at the time, who they are. That's the beauty of this. It's who you are, what your background is, combined with your current purposes. And that current purpose changes from minute to minute. Which is fundamentally why the flexibility, the benefits of the flexibility probably outweigh the cost of whatever you might perceive of as a precision. And the output. David, what are some of what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Oh, what you guys want from this stuff? Because we can change. We can, I think it's the goal is to make a dictionary that's adaptable, right? That presents people use dictionary for different reasons. We present them with a variety of information that can be tailored in a new sort of way, depending on what the specific instances of the research. But yeah.
No, I actually think that purchase has gone a long way toward that in its development over the years with that word study tool or through publications, search for this word in this author or in this genre or in the collection. I think you guys have already done a whole lot that is precisely, the kind of thing that the obsessive philologist would want.
So the question, I hear the serious question is, why, how come no one of the obsessive philologists actually seems to use any of these tools?
Well,
I
think that because you just asked the question, you say, well, how do you assess these metrics? We have built, there's all that stuff at the top, and we've never as far as I know, looked to say who uses them, how often, how often. And in some ways, it's because there's no metric to measure how long someone's eye actually passes over something on the page, but something else without...
Well, you just find that it's not just an already bought the fancy eye tracker. And
right, but do we know? I mean, that is the question. We have all that stuff.
The anecdotal evidence is that nobody, they look at it, they don't get it.
Right. And I do think that, I mean, what we do know was Bruce complains about, rightly so, that students look at the dictionary definition and take the first one. When we extracted the definition, the short definition from Perseus, we took the first one because we didn't have any better way to do it, so we took the first one. And that killed the middle, basically, online. That people look at the first one, if they don't get it, they just go to the big. That basically nobody uses the middle anymore. Because they're out. And most people, most of the time, want the first one. They don't go to any lexicon once they see that first thing. Both of which has, I think, real implications for them, what an automatic. And say you have an automatically generated dictionary that gets 85% of the words correct. B plus B, better grade here than me. The student's going to go and look at the first one. They're going to be really, really wrong at least 15% of the time. Where you don't have that judgment, that human judgment brought into bear, I'm not sure how that interfaces with this problem of students also not being able to make those human judgments and just go.
But you don't, yeah, so the first meaning, right, and not thinking through, there's two things going on there. One is they want the morphological parts, right? And the other is they want the meaning of the word, right?
Right, that's right.
You don't have a way to separate those two in the current system, right? So you don't know whether they were going for that first exciting meaning or that this was, you know, the first person present, right? You don't know that for sure.
Just like you don't know who reads the frequency data and the qualification data. We know it's there, we know we think it's neat.
Show of hands, how many people use it? How many people tell their students about it and how to use it? But, you know, look at this table, this is what it does for you. This is, you know, if you're trying to pick between two words in a sentence, want to pick the more common one. If their frequency number is above such and so, you'd better memorize the word, and stuff like that.
And that's one of the major things that the word TLG has been mentioned, and I was not the first one. I just want to point out. That's one of the things that just completely is lacking there. Frequency information, right? You can search for it, you'll get the occurrences. There's no indication of frequency whatsoever, which is just, you know, makes it very, that's very crucial information that's happening.
Frequency of individual words.
Get to compare. Sorry?
Frequency of individual words, get.
I mean, frequency, if I have 50 instances of Thucydides versus 50 instances of Sophocles, we use the word more. That's the kind of thing, right? Where it's very straightforward, not available. Right? How does the distribution change over time? I don't know, you know, how many volumes of Josephus there are, and therefore how frequent this is. It's one of the very basic things that Mr. Crane, a big smile on his face, has done. That is, if you're going to be pretending to be the engine for research, blah blah, then you should be able to do that. Very simple.
Well, very good. I think nothing interests me more than online dictionaries, since I began by winding up Middle more than 20 years ago, Peggy and doing the work needing to hang out of the bag. Not to do it, which is why it's good things are vanished and that